Your black is beautiful. Your black is beautiful. And if there's anything better than being beautiful, it's being smart. If there's anything better than being smart, it's being kind. And reaffirming that every day is our method of making sure her chin never drops. My dad wasn't around, and I remember riding a bike and falling off and cutting myself, and me never just wanting to get back on it. People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike, and you didn't. I didn't teach them. I just created an environment where they taught themselves, and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLL Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJN Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Boston Globe. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Jean from the Talking Information Center reading the Boston Globe for Tuesday, February 24, 2026. Monster storm hammers southern New England with high winds and more than 2 feet of snow, by Danny McDonald and Ken Mahan. A historic bomb cyclone walloped the region on Monday, dumping more than 2 feet of snow on parts of southern New England, breaking snowfall records in Massachusetts, knocking out power to more than 250,000 residents, and prompting the state's first travel ban in over a decade. The first blizzard to hit New England since 2022 brought blinding snow and brutal winds and even thunder snow, particularly to Cape Cod and the South Coast. With 33.7 inches, Whitman set a record for a 24-hour snowfall total, according to the Globe's weather team. The previous record was held by Natick, which had 29 inches, during the April Fool's Day storm in 1997. Logan Airport in Boston recorded 16.9 inches, the National Weather Service said Monday night. Some city neighborhoods received higher amounts, officials said. Dighton, New Bedford, Swansea, and Taunton all reported snowfalls of more than 2 feet from Monday's nor'easter. 30 inches of snow is no joke, that's for sure, said Jonathan Darling, a spokesperson for the city of New Bedford. Governor Maura Healey issued a travel ban in the four hardest-hit counties, Barnstable, Bristol, Dukes, and Plymouth. The MBTA will continue to operate Tuesday with reduced service, officials said. Dozens of school districts across the state will be closed Tuesday for a second straight day as communities start to dig out. This storm has been a doozy, said Healey during an afternoon press conference. As of late Monday night, there were still more than 269,534 power outages in Massachusetts. And with winds slow to die down, power restoration efforts could not immediately begin, officials said. Residents could be facing a multi-day power restoration, and state officials asked for the public to be patient. The main issue for getting the power back will be access for utility crews, they said. The wind needs to abate in some parts of New England for crews in bucket trucks to safely reach downed lines, and the roads have to be clear for crews to get to problem areas, according to authorities. In Scituate, residents were told to brace for multiple days without power. Things are a mess, said town administrator James Boudreau. The storm also hit Rhode Island hard, breaking records there set by the blizzard of 78. By 8 p.m., the T.F. Green Airport had reached 37.9 inches. The storm paralyzed road travel and grounded hundreds of local flights. It lashed coastal areas, with some towns on Cape Cod and the islands recording winds topping 70 miles per hour. Nantucket was blasted by a 78-mile-per-hour wind gust, the strength of a Category 1 hurricane, shortly after 10:30 a.m. The Globe Weather Team said the nor'easter accelerated on Sunday night into a bomb cyclone, meaning it underwent what we call bombogenesis, in which it technically bombed out, with its central pressure dropping 24 millibars or greater within 24 hours. The snow fell heavily for hours while high winds whipped through the region, and the gnarly conditions prompted Healy to issue a ban on non-essential vehicle travel in a huge section of southeastern Massachusetts because of dangerous road conditions. Downed power lines, felled trees, and abandoned and stuck cars complicated the state's response to the storm, a state official said. State police reported responding to more than 400 disabled vehicles on the state's roadways through Monday afternoon. Those caught violating the travel ban could face a $500 fine, according to officials. The National Guard deployed personnel and equipment to Duxbury and Pembroke to assist with snow removal and emergency services calls, according to the town's fire departments. At one point, utility companies reported more than 350,000 customers without power Monday across eastern Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. A handful of emergency shelters were opened in the areas hardest hit by power outages, including Plymouth, Cape Cod, and Rhode Island. 17 warming stations were also opened in eastern Massachusetts. Residents appeared to heed officials' calls to stay off the roads. Downtown Boston was a relative ghost town Monday, but South Station was open overnight to allow people to shelter there as an emergency option only, according to an MBTA spokesperson. During the January 25 snowstorm, the state came under fire for not allowing dozens of homeless people to remain overnight at South Station as 2 feet of snow fell in Boston. Many people instead had to find their way to the nearby South Station bus terminal, where they were allowed inside even if they did not have a bus ticket. Transportation officials in the state redeployed equipment to the South Coast to help cities and towns there deal with the snowfall. According to officials, motorists should expect a reduced level of service on highways statewide for a prolonged period. Officials in Massachusetts also restricted truck travel on interstate highways until further notice and reduced the speed limit on the Massachusetts Turnpike to 40 miles per hour. At Boston's Logan International Airport, more than 970 flights were grounded because of the storm. The MBTA's buses, subway, and commuter rail operated on a reduced schedule, something that would continue into Tuesday, officials said. Ferry service was canceled. Amtrak also canceled dozens of scheduled train trips in the region on Monday. And other aspects of New England's day-to-day ground to a halt. Some Dunkin's, the ubiquitous coffee chain as synonymous with Greater Boston as clam chowder and non-rotic accents, shut down. Market Basket, the grocery chain with a cult-like following, closed all of its Massachusetts locations at noon. Food delivery apps announced moratoriums. Quality Mart in Boston's Back Bay is apparently made of tougher stuff. The corner store stayed open, selling some staples, eggs, milk, and bread, during the brunt of the storm. "We do it for the neighbors," said Chafik Hamada, general manager of the store at 21 Massachusetts Avenue. "People depend upon us, so we make sure we get here and we open for them, and anything they need is available." To reach blizzard status, a storm must have whiteout conditions with visibility of a quarter mile or less for at least 3 consecutive hours as a result of snow along with winds of at least 35 miles per hour. Multiple localities hit that mark on Monday, including Boston, Worcester, Providence, and the Cape and Islands. In Winthrop, multiple water main breaks Monday, caused by power outages at the pressure relief valve stations, resulted in flooding, and the town's Department of Public Works briefly shutting down water service townwide. A large tree toppled onto a house in Wellesley Monday morning, police said, but no injuries were reported. In Boston, the city had no reports of flooding, but did receive a couple dozen calls for downed trees, officials said. Local officials in Massachusetts encouraged people to stay off the roads as the heavy, wet snow and winds created whiteout conditions. They're asking the same for Tuesday, as more people out and about could complicate snow removal efforts and emergency responses, according to authorities. We need everyone to continue to stay home because going out can make things more difficult and dangerous, said Boston Mayor Michelle Wu during a news conference late Monday afternoon. The snow emergency parking ban will continue in Boston until at least 6 p.m. Tuesday, as crews will work to widen passable parts of thoroughfares to the curb, officials said. Are you stressed right now? Me too, because snow days aren't a break when you're a working parent. By Kara Baskin. Certain phrases strike fear into the heart of every parent. Please check your child for head lice. We will need chaperones for a field trip to an ant farm 50 miles from civilization. The bus leaves at 7:30 a.m. tomorrow. And the biggie, school has been canceled due to weather conditions. I maintain a Pavlovian response to snow day announcements. Excitement, joy, a reprieve from daily life. This lingers from my 1990s childhood when I'd listen to Dave Maynard on WBZ for the alphabetical list of school cancellations. But back in the 1990s, I wasn't a working parent. For those of us who need to work and also have children, snow days are not a day off. They're a logistical nightmare consisting of iPads, babysitting exchanges with neighbors, I shoveled my third grader next door for a couple hours, and Zoom calls that recall the most awkward days of COVID. Wouldn't it be amazing if our workplaces also called off all obligations due to inclement weather? Imagine receiving an email from HR declaring, "Due to foul weather conditions, we insist that you spend the day baking cookies, changing from nighttime to daytime pajamas, or sledding like a Norman Rockwell painting. Do not check email. Do not even think of coming into the office. Revel in childlike joy while the wind whips past your windows. And please, accomplish nothing. P.S., as part of company benefits, each employee will also receive a complimentary massage to recover from shoveling." It might feel like Scandinavia outside, but we don't live there. Work-life balance is a myth, and snow days are not a reprieve. For many of us, they're just one more thing to manage. Truthfully, the issue here is the American workplace and not snow days. If they shifted and respected families more, there would be no stress, says Needham's Laura Goldfarb. Some of us have to report to on-site work no matter what, necessitating childcare roulette. For those of us working from home, snow days mean refereeing arguments in between emails, juggling work, kids, and the guilt of not making the day feel magical. But who has time for something as frivolous as magic when you need a paycheck in one of the most expensive parts of the country to start a family? Rachel Kantrowitz is a single, self-employed mom in Arlington. Snow days are not blissful, they're a burden. Snow days seem like one more thing in a long list that assumes both traditional employment with the ability to take days off and a two-parent household with the ability to take turns parenting and working. Neither is the case for me, so it feels like a lose-lose situation where I either meet client deadlines and ignore my kid or risk my professionalism and delay work to be present with my kid, she says. Snow days don't run on hot chocolate. They run on self-reproach. One person told me that I should log off and do a puzzle with my kid because childhood goes by so fast. The only puzzle I'm working on is figuring out how much work I can accomplish before my third grader comes home from next door and wants his iPad. And I'm in good company. My husband and I are working from home today and tagging in and out to keep our 8 and 4-year-olds entertained and the sibling fighting to a minimum. The lights have been flickering and now the internet is out, so while snow days are often about lowered screen time restrictions for us without movies to stream, they're getting bored, and it's only 10 a.m. It's so difficult when we also have to work when they're home. They know I'm here, but I can't always be available, and I feel so bad, says Catherine Tonsberg Seifert in Milford. I want to tell Seifert not to feel bad, but that would be hypocritical. I feel the exact same way. I should be outside making memories, or at least encouraging my teenager to step slowly away from his video games before he turns into a robot. Speaking of robots, it's a good thing I didn't sign his brother up for a robotics camp that begins at the end of June, since each snow day nibbles into camp time. For those of us who rely on summer camp as childcare, this poses a perhaps non-refundable conundrum. Take it from Victor Grigas in Concord, a father of three who is playing store with his children while his wife is locked in her bedroom working. He also works part-time. We have to count the days that it extends into the summer because you have to book summer camps in January and February, and when snow days happen, the school district needs to make up for it with extra days, and that bleeds into the summer camp time, Grigas says, adding hopefully, I'm just glad the power hasn't gone out yet. This blizzard's timing, on the tail of a school vacation week, adds an extra icy layer of chaos. Not only are my two youngest kids now on extended school vacation because of the snow, which is tough because I work from home, but my oldest still isn't home from his class trip. He was delayed in Tokyo and is now delayed in Toronto, says Franklin's Aaron Gouveia, adding, he was supposed to be home last night, but now it's looking like Wednesday. Also, our fridge died over the weekend. Oh, and we decided to adopt a new dog on Sunday, and introducing it to our existing dog and two cats means absolute havoc right now, as more than 2 feet of snow drops. I tried to leave the house and go outside for 5 minutes just to clear my head, but I couldn't get the side door open. If you're lucky, you work with people in the exact same boat. Hustle culture might demand that we work from home. Empathetic colleagues are the antidote. It's not exactly universal time off, but it does help. But not everyone extends that kind of leeway. Instead, workers who juggle family responsibilities feel penalized. A mother in Maynard, requesting anonymity to protect her professional life, said, I work in a job where most of my coworkers have grown kids, a stay-at-home parent, or are childless. They can reschedule meetings and continue on remotely. My husband and I can sometimes switch off, but even while doing that, there is no time to prepare for scheduled meetings and be fully present. I ended up calling out for my important company-wide call. Everyone else will participate. I will be left out and become more behind. Makes me wonder, what would happen if we really could unplug? I don't mean losing power, although my lights are flickering off and on at the moment. What if we came to a universal understanding that just because we can work remotely doesn't mean that we should? This goes for everyone, not just those of us with kids. What if everyone who has a life beyond work could simply power down, take a breath, and go outside in the snow? Hell might have to freeze over. In the words of one parent who messaged me as soon as I put out an ask, gone are the days of just having a snow day and taking it as found time to embrace your children and family time. In 2026, that's as antiquated a notion as crowding around the radio, listening for an alphabetical list of school cancellations. Supreme Court to weigh oil industry effort to end a major climate suit, by Karen Zrake. The Supreme Court announced Monday that it had agreed to hear a major climate lawsuit in which the oil industry is claiming it shouldn't be sued in state courts over its role in global warming. The outcome could have wide bearing on dozens of other lawsuits around the country. The court said it would hear arguments on a petition by ExxonMobil and Suncor, a Canadian energy giant, in a lawsuit brought by the city and county of Boulder, Colorado. The suit, first filed in 2018, sought to hold the companies liable for the effects of climate change, citing state laws. About three dozen similar lawsuits have been filed in the United States by state, local, and tribal governments in the past decade. They generally seek monetary damages for costs that municipalities are incurring because of climate change. Many also make consumer fraud claims, arguing the companies covered up what they knew about the risks of using their products. Some have been dismissed, while others have been allowed to advance in the courts. None have made it to trial yet. In Colorado, as they have elsewhere, the companies tried to move the matter to federal court, arguing that the complex issue of global greenhouse gas emissions must be addressed under federal, not state, law. A federal judge denied that request in 2019, and the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the decision. The companies asked the Supreme Court to step in then, but the justices declined. The Supreme Court had also declined to hear several similar petitions over the years. But that changed amid a vigorous push by the oil industry and the Trump administration to shut down climate lawsuits nationwide. They argue that the specter of billions of dollars in damages could destroy the U.S. energy sector. The Justice Department sued Hawaii and Michigan in a bid to stop those states from filing climate lawsuits, and industry allies have redoubled their efforts to get the courts and lawmakers to block the cases. Conservative legal scholar John Yoo, who submitted an amicus brief in the Boulder case, wrote in a recent essay that the justices must end environmental extortion of American energy. States have not been deterred. Hawaii filed its lawsuit almost immediately after the Justice Department suit. And Michigan recently filed a federal antitrust lawsuit against four oil companies and the American Petroleum Institute, the oil industry's main trade group. The petition before the justices in the Boulder case hinges on the case of whether federal law precludes state law claims seeking relief for injuries allegedly caused by greenhouse gas emissions. The justices on Monday also asked the parties to answer additional questions about whether the Supreme Court could step into the dispute right now. Michelle Harrison, Deputy U.S. Legal Director for the nonprofit Earth Rights International and one of the lawyers for Boulder, said the additional questions reflected issues that Boulder had raised. Boulder had argued, for example, that there was no final judgment from a lower court to review, so it was premature for the justices to intervene. The debate could also be shaken up by the Environmental Protection Agency's recent killing of the endangerment finding. That scientific determination by the EPA had been the foundation of federal greenhouse gas regulations under the Clean Air Act. The Supreme Court has previously ruled that the EPA's role in managing those regulations blocked many federal lawsuits over harms from climate change. Some legal experts say the end of the endangerment finding opens up a new lane for lawsuits against the fossil fuel industry in federal court. Harrison said those fast-moving developments were another reason why it's not appropriate for the court to wade into these issues at this time. She pointed to a brief submitted by the Trump administration, which argued the lawsuits were preempted by the Clean Air Act. That argument itself could become a moot point if the agency no longer oversees greenhouse gas regulations. The court's announcement could also have more immediate repercussions for the various climate lawsuits proceeding around the country. Michael Girard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University, said he expected that the oil companies would ask state courts to put the cases on hold until the justices reach a decision. It will be up to each state court to decide, he said. As that shakes out, and as lawsuits against the EPA's elimination of the endangerment findings start to pile up, the industry has stayed focused on seeking ways to shut down climate litigation entirely. The American Petroleum Institute, which is named in several of the lawsuits, has called ending the lawsuits one of its top goals this year. Like the Trump administration, the group has also taken aim at new climate Superfund laws that were recently enacted in New York and Vermont and that have been discussed in several other states. These laws are designed to extract financial penalties from companies based on the amount of greenhouse gases they have put into the atmosphere. Both the Superfund laws and the lawsuits operate on the polluter pays principle. Now a congressional effort to protect oil companies from both is afoot. Over the summer, Republican state attorneys general called for a liability shield for the industry, similar to the one that protects gun manufacturers from lawsuits. Representative Harriet Hageman, Republican of Wyoming, said recently that she was working on writing such legislation. After Monday's announcement, officials in Boulder again pointed to the mounting costs associated with global warming. We are hopeful that the Supreme Court will not hamstring our right under Colorado law to seek the resources needed to build a safer, more resilient future, said Jonathan Cohn, Climate Initiatives Director for the City of Boulder. Curtis A. Smith, a spokesperson for Exxon, said, "As our filings make clear, climate policy shouldn't be set through fragmented state court actions, and we look forward to making that case before the court." Suncor did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The Trump administration's brief had urged the justices to take up the Boulder case and stop the growing number of climate lawsuits. Senior Justice Department officials wrote that the threat of endless litigation and a patchwork of conflicting regulations across the country loomed over the case. If it were allowed to continue, they wrote, then every locality in the country could sue essentially anyone in the world for contributing to global climate change. Judge bars release of special counsel report on Trump's mishandling of documents, by Alan Foyer. A Trump-appointed federal judge Monday permanently barred the Justice Department from releasing a report by special counsel Jack Smith detailing President Trump's mishandling of reams of classified documents after he left the White House in 2021. The ruling by Judge Aileen Cannon was her latest effort in the past several months to keep the public from seeing Smith's sprawling report, one of the most significant parts of his twin prosecutions of Trump that has yet to see the light of day. The order, issued from U.S. District Court in Fort Pierce, Florida, slammed Smith for the brazen stratagem of drafting his report even after Cannon had dismissed the classified documents case in July 2024 and found that he had been improperly appointed to his post as special counsel. To say this chronology represents, at a minimum, a concerning breach of the spirit of the dismissal order is an understatement, if not an outright violation of it, Cannon wrote Monday. Cannon also ruled that releasing the report, which contains investigative materials that have never been made public, would cause irreparable damage to Trump and his two co-defendants and would contravene basic notions of fairness and justice in the process. Smith himself dropped the other case he brought against Trump, the one accusing him of seeking to overturn the 2020 election after the 2024 election. The report about the election interference case, often described as Volume 1 of his work, was released to the public in January 2025. But Volume 2 of Smith's report has never been released, even though special counsels appointed by both Republican and Democratic administrations have traditionally shown their work to the public. Volume 2 details Smith's prosecution of Trump on charges of illegally retaining highly sensitive classified documents from his first stint in the White House, and then conspiring with his co-defendants, Waltine Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira, to obstruct the government's repeated efforts to get the material back. Last month, Smith testified in front of Congress about several aspects of his election interference prosecution, flatly accusing Trump of causing the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. But he has never been able to discuss his findings in the classified documents case publicly because Cannon, who has repeatedly received lavish praise from the president, temporarily blocked the release of his report about it shortly before Trump returned to office. The order Monday made that preliminary ruling permanent, though it is unlikely to be the last word on the matter. Two watchdog groups, American Oversight and the Knight First Amendment Institute, have been trying for months to force the release of Smith's report, filing a series of requests to the federal appeals court that sits over Cannon. Both organizations denounce the ruling. Judge Cannon's ruling continues a troubling pattern of decisions that shield the president from public scrutiny and place secrecy above the public's right to know. Chioma Chukwu, the executive director of American Oversight, said in a statement issued Monday, "By permanently blocking the release of Volume 2 of the special counsel's report and denying our effort to seek a stay while our appeal moves forward, the court has ensured that the public is denied information of extraordinary national importance." Scott Wilkins, senior counsel at the Knight Institute, echoed the criticism. "Judge Cannon's decision to permanently block the release of this extraordinarily significant report is impossible to square with the First Amendment and the common law," he said. Cannon's decision came in response to a request from Trump's lawyers, who had argued that Volume 2 of Smith's report should never be released outside the Justice Department because it was the work product of a special counsel who never should have been appointed in the first place. Lawyers for Nauta and De Oliveira made an even broader request, asking Cannon to destroy all copies of the report. While the judge granted Trump's request, she rejected the effort to have all remaining copies of Volume 2 destroyed. In an unusual, but perhaps unsurprising move, the Justice Department weighed in on the issue last month, agreeing with Trump and telling Cannon that the report should remain sealed. "The illicit product of an unlawful investigation and prosecution belongs in the dustbin of history," prosecutors wrote. "The United States will leave it there." Police are finding suspects based on their online searches as courts weigh privacy concerns. By Mark Scolforo. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Criminal investigators, hoping to develop suspects in difficult cases, have been asking Google to reveal who searched for specific information online, seeking reverse keyword warrants that critics warn threaten the privacy of innocent people. Unlike traditional search warrants that target a known suspect or location, keyword warrants work backward by identifying internet addresses where searches were made in a certain window of time for particular terms, such as a street address where a crime occurred or a phrase like pipe bomb. Police have used the method to investigate a series of bombings in Texas, the assassination of a Brazilian politician, and a fatal arson in Colorado. It's not a wild guess by investigators to conclude that people are using Google searches in all manner of crimes, as the company's search engine has become the main gateway to the internet and users' daily lives increasingly leave online traces. The potential value to investigators of the data Google collects is obvious in cases with no suspect, such as the search for Nancy Guthrie's kidnapper. The legal tension between the need to solve crimes quickly and the U.S. Constitution's Fourth Amendment protections against overly broad searches was at the heart of a recent Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision that upheld the use of a reverse keyword warrant in a rape investigation. Privacy advocates see it as giving police unfettered access to the thoughts, feelings, concerns, and secrets of countless people, according to an amicus brief filed in the Pennsylvania appeal by the American Civil Liberties Union, the Internet Archive, and several library organizations. In response to written questions about the warrants, Google provided an emailed statement, quote, "Our processes for handling law enforcement requests are designed to protect users' privacy while meeting our legal obligations. We review all legal demands for legal validity, and we push back against those that are overboard or improper, including objecting to some entirely," close quote. Pennsylvania state police were stymied in their investigation into the violent rape of a woman in 2016 on a remote cul-de-sac outside Milton, a small community in the center of the state. With no clear leads, police obtained a warrant directing Google to disclose accounts that searched for the victim's name or address over the week when she was attacked. More than a year later, Google reported two searches for the woman's address were made a few hours before the assault from a specific IP address, a numeric designation that lists where a phone or computer lives on the Internet. That led them to the home of a state prison guard named John Edward Kurtz. Police then conducted surveillance and collected a cigarette butt he discarded that matched DNA recovered from the victim, according to court records. He confessed to the rape and attacks involving four other women over a five-year period and was convicted in 2020. Now 51, he's been sentenced to 59 to 280 years. Kurtz's attorneys argued police lacked probable cause to obtain the information and impinged on his privacy rights. The state Supreme Court rejected those claims late last year, but split on the reasons why. Three justices said Kurtz should not have expected his Google searches to be private, while three more said police had probable cause to look for anyone who searched the victim's address before the attack. But a dissenting justice said probable cause requires more than just a bald hunch and guessing that a perpetrator would have used Google. Kurtz's lawyer, Douglas Taglieri, made the same point in a court filing but conceded it was a good guess. Julia Skinner, a prosecutor in the case, said reverse keyword searches are much more effective when there are specific and even unusual terms that can narrow results, such as a distinctive name or an address. They are also particularly effective when crimes appear to have been planned out beforehand, she said. I don't think they're used super frequently, because what you need to target has to be so specific, she said. There were 57 searches returned in the Kurtz case, but many of them were first responders trying to locate the home in the immediate aftermath of the crime, Skinner said. In a similar case in Colorado, police sought the IP addresses of anyone who searched over a 15-day period for the address of a home where a deadly arson occurred. Authorities got IP addresses for 61 searches made by 8 accounts, ultimately helping identify 3 teenage suspects. The Colorado Supreme Court ruled in 2023 that although the keyword warrant was constitutionally defective for not specifying an individualized probable cause, the evidence could be used because police had acted in good faith about what was known about the law at the time. If dystopian problems emerge, as some fear, the courts stand ready to hear argument regarding how we should rein in law enforcement's use of rapidly advancing technology, the majority of Colorado justices ruled. Courts have long permitted investigators to seek things like bank records or phone logs. However, civil liberties groups say extending those powers to online keywords turns every search user into a suspect. It's unclear how many keyword warrants are issued every year. Google does not break down the total number of warrants it receives by type, according to the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Pennsylvania Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in a January 2024 brief. The two groups said police working on the bombings in Austin, Texas, sought anyone who searched for terms such as low explosives and pipe bomb. And in Brazil, investigators trying to solve the 2018 assassination in Rio de Janeiro of the politician Marielle Franco asked for those who searched for Franco's name and the street where she lived. A Brazilian high court is expected to decide soon on the legality of those search disclosures. Reverse keyword warrants are distinct from geofence warrants, where criminal investigators seek information about who was in a given area at a particular time. The U.S. Supreme Court said last month it will rule on that method's constitutionality. For many people, their Google search history contains some of their most personal thoughts, from health issues and political beliefs to financial decisions and spending patterns. Google is introducing more artificial intelligence into its search engine, seemingly a way to learn even more about users. What could be more embarrassing? Asked University of Pennsylvania law professor and civil rights lawyer David Rudofsky, if every Google search was now out there, gone viral. Google warns users personal information can be shared outside the company when it has a good faith belief that disclosure of the information is reasonably necessary to respond to applicable laws, regulations, legal processes, or an enforceable government request. In the Kurtz case, Pennsylvania Justice David Wecht drew a distinction between Kurtz deciding to search for the victim's name on Google and a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court decision that limited the use of broad collections of cell phone location data. A user who wants to keep such material private has options, Wecht wrote. That user does not have to click on Google. European support for Ukraine stumbles on eve of invasion's fourth anniversary, by Gianna Smialek and Constant Miu. Brussels. The European Union had hoped to make a big show of support for Ukraine this week on the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion and at a moment when there has been little sign of progress in U.S.-mediated efforts to end the war. But those plans have been upended after Hungary said that it would block the latest package of sanctions against Russia and that it would also stall progress on an already agreed-to financial aid package for Ukraine. Unfortunately, we did not reach an agreement on the 20th sanctions package, Kaya Kallas, the EU's top diplomat, said at a news conference after a meeting of foreign ministers in Brussels on Monday. This is a setback and message we didn't want to send today. The sanctions package could still pass with time, and officials and diplomats are also hoping that the delay to the aid package is a snag and not a derailment. Nonetheless, the problems underscore how the bloc's consensus-based decision-making process can grind to a standstill. Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary, who has maintained friendly relations with Russia and is a frequent critic of Ukraine, has repeatedly delayed EU sanctions in the past, only to eventually allow them through. He faces an election in April and is trailing in some polls. For Ukraine, the move creates uncertainty at a critical juncture. Ukraine will soon need the aid package worth 90 billion euros, about $106 billion, to fund both defenses and day-to-day needs, and had expected the first installments of the loan to arrive in the coming months. Ukrainian officials have said that they need the funds to start being dispersed by this spring to avoid a budget crunch. Hungary's decision to object to the financial assistance program for Ukraine was unexpected. It had already been agreed to in December, and Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic had signed off on the condition that they would not have to pay costs related to the loan. Kallas called the backtracking really regrettable and said that it is not the kind of cooperation that is expected from EU members. Kallas noted that European officials had originally planned to use Russian frozen assets to make the loan, an idea that fell through in December. She suggested that it might be possible to resurrect that approach should other avenues fail. "We can always go back to using the frozen assets," she said. Hungary said that it would block the sanctions and the aid package because of disruptions to the Druzhba pipeline, which runs through Ukraine and supplies Russian crude oil to Hungary and Slovakia. Ukraine has said that the pipeline was damaged by a Russian attack in late January and that repairs were continuing. But Hungary and Slovakia have accused Ukraine of stalling and of deliberately restricting oil supplies. In response, Hungary and Slovakia announced last week that they would halt diesel supplies to Kyiv, just as Ukraine faces huge energy shortages as a result of Russian military strikes. Then on Monday, Prime Minister Robert Fico of Slovakia announced his country would stop emergency electricity supplies to Ukraine until Kyiv resumed oil supplies through the Druzhba pipeline. Slovakia has supplied about one-fifth of Ukraine's total electricity imports so far this month. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry condemned the threats by Hungary and Slovakia, describing them as ultimatums and blackmail in a statement Saturday. Such actions, in the context of massive and targeted Russian strikes on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, are provocative, irresponsible, and threaten the energy security of the entire region, the ministry said. Orban escalated the spat Sunday. "We will secure Hungary's fuel supply and take necessary countermeasures until shipments resume," Orban wrote on social media. EU officials had hoped to agree on the bloc's 20th sanctions package at the meeting of foreign ministers on Monday, a day before the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Two of the bloc's leaders, Ursula von der Leyen and Antonio Costa will be in Kyiv on Tuesday to commemorate the date. The new sanctions package includes a full maritime services ban for Russian crude oil, which was meant to slash Moscow's energy revenues. Hungary has delayed such packages before. Orbán has also sought to weaken or overturn key provisions of sanctions, and he has previously used his veto to extract concessions from Brussels. The Hungarian government is once again blackmailing Ukraine, Radoslav Sikorski, Poland's foreign minister, told reporters while leaving the meeting Monday. Efforts to end the war have shown relatively little sign of progress, with the last round of U.S.-mediated talks ending last week. While U.S. officials have voiced optimism that Russia and Ukraine might be headed for a breakthrough, European officials expressed doubts. I do not see any readiness on the Russian side to really, in the substance, come to a compromise, Johann Vadaful, the German foreign minister, said as he walked into the meeting in Brussels on Monday. Europe should be on Ukraine's side, he added. We are the supporters of Ukraine. Students in Iran hold anti-government protests as U.S. forces gather for possible strikes. By Amir Hussein Raji and Karim Chahayeb. Cairo. Students held anti-government protests at universities across Iran's capital on Monday, according to witnesses and videos circulating online, in a new sign of unrest as U.S. forces gather in the region for possible strikes. The protests, in which many students express support for the exiled crown prince of Iran's long-deposed monarchy, began over the weekend. Demonstrations erupted on at least three university campuses on Monday, in one instance leading to scuffles with the paramilitary Basij. Iran launched a fierce crackdown in January on mass protests, killing thousands of people and detaining tens of thousands. President Trump threatened military action in response before shifting his focus to Iran's disputed nuclear program and warning it to make a deal. American and Iranian negotiators are set to hold another round of indirect talks in Geneva this week, where Iran is expected to make a detailed proposal on reining in its nuclear program. The USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier, is meanwhile heading toward the Middle East to join another carrier. Iran says its nuclear program is entirely peaceful and that it hasn't enriched uranium since 12 days of Israeli and U.S. strikes last June. The United States and others have long suspected Iran of seeking nuclear weapons. Iran has not allowed inspections of its nuclear sites since they were heavily bombed last year. Nationwide protests erupted late last year after Iran's currency collapsed in the face of long-standing U.S. sanctions over the nuclear program. Demonstrators have called for the overthrow of the Shiite theocracy that has ruled the country since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Protests broke out Monday at Sharif University, an elite college in the capital, according to a student. The student said he and his classmates gathered outside a cafeteria midday before donning face masks and clapping and chanting during the Muslim call to prayer over loudspeakers. As the crowd swelled, one student held up a printed flag emblazoned with the lion and sun of the monarchy, as dozens chanted slogans supporting exiled Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi. The student said scuffles broke out between protesters and members of the Basij, which has played a key role in quashing dissent over the years, as university security guards tried to separate the two. At the University of Tehran, a protest broke out during a memorial for a student killed in the earlier demonstrations, a student said. Students chanted, "Women, Life, Freedom," the slogan of an earlier wave of protests in 2022, and called for the overthrow of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The student said university guards did not interfere. Both students spoke on condition of anonymity out of security concerns. Videos seen and verified by the Associated Press showed other protests at Al-Zahra University, where female students gathered and chanted pro-Pahlavi slogans. It's difficult to gauge support for Pahlavi inside Iran, But some of the biggest protests in years broke out in early January after he called people into the streets. Trump threatened military action over the killing of protesters and possible mass executions as authorities moved to stamp out those demonstrations. The U.S.-based Human Rights Activists News Agency says at least 7,015 people were killed in the protests and crackdown in recent months, including 214 government forces. The group has been accurate in counting deaths during previous rounds of unrest in Iran and relies on a network of activists there to verify deaths. The death toll continues to rise as the group cross-checks information. Iran's government offered its only death toll from the previous protests on January 21, saying 3,117 people were killed. Iran's theocracy has undercounted or not reported fatalities from past unrest. The Associated Press has been unable to independently assess the death toll, in part because of major disruptions to communication networks in Iran. State Department orders non-essential U.S. diplomats to leave Lebanon as tensions with Iran soar. By Matthew Lee. The United States has ordered non-essential diplomats and their family members at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut to leave Lebanon, the State Department said Monday, as tensions over Iran rise with the threat of a potentially imminent military strike. The department said in an updated travel alert for U.S. citizens in Lebanon that it ordered the departure of non-emergency U.S. government personnel and family members of government personnel due to the security situation in Beirut. The alert, which was formally released several hours after word began to circulate about the move, said U.S. personnel remaining in Lebanon would have their in-country travel restricted. A department official said earlier that a continuous assessment of the regional security environment determined it was prudent to draw down the U.S. Embassy Beirut's footprint so that only essential personnel remain at their posts. The official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity before the move was formally announced, said that it is a temporary measure and that the embassy will remain operational. Lebanon has been the site of numerous Iran-related retaliatory attacks against U.S. facilities, interests, and personnel for decades, given Tehran's support for and influence with the Hezbollah militant group, which is held responsible for the deadly bombings of the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983 and an embassy annex in 1984. As such, changes in the staffing status of the embassy in Beirut have often been seen as a bellwether for potential U.S. or Israeli military action in the region, particularly against Iran. A similar ordered departure was imposed for Beirut and other embassies in the region, including in Iraq, shortly before President Trump ordered military strikes against Iranian nuclear facilities last June. It was unclear whether other American embassies in the Middle East would implement similar orders. Tensions have escalated between the United States and Iran as Trump has built up the largest military presence in the Middle East in decades and repeatedly threatened action if Tehran does not negotiate a deal to constrain its nuclear program. A second aircraft carrier is heading to the region to join a surge of other American warships and aircraft, offering the Republican president several options for a potential strike, even as talks may continue. Oman's foreign minister, Badr al-Busaidi, said the United States and Iran plan to hold their next round of nuclear talks next Thursday in Geneva. A U.S. official, who was not authorized to comment publicly, then spoke on the condition of anonymity, confirmed the meeting. Iran's top diplomat, Abbas Araghchi, told CBS on Sunday that he expected to meet U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff then and said a good chance remained for a diplomatic solution on the nuclear issue. Araghchi has said a proposed deal would be ready to share within days, and he told CBS that Iran was still working on it. Asked Friday whether the United States could take limited military action as the countries negotiate, Trump said, "I guess I can say I am considering that." He also told reporters that Iran better negotiate a fair deal. Indirect talks between the longtime adversaries in recent weeks have made little visible progress. Beyond the nuclear program, Iran has refused to discuss wider U.S. and Israeli demands that it scale back its missile program and sever ties to armed groups. A second State Department official, also speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss plans that had not been formally announced, said Secretary of State Marco Rubio may delay his intended visit to Israel this weekend. Winter storm strands Boston area residents hoping to make it home. By Jamie Moore Carrillo and Shannon Larson. Zachary Smith's short excursion to Dallas took a sudden and unwelcome turn this weekend. The 38-year-old Cambridge resident had hoped to spend a few days with friends before returning home to his wife, who Smith says is 6 months pregnant. But a brutal blizzard that upended air travel across the eastern seaboard left him stranded. The winter storm that hammered New England has immobilized air traffic at its largest airport. More than 1,000 flights to and from Logan Airport were canceled Sunday and Monday, according to flight tracking website FlightAware. Hundreds more were grounded for Tuesday. And blizzard conditions were only one factor in a day of travel trauma. Compounding the problems were a partial government shutdown that affected international travel and security concerns in parts of western Mexico. Airlines suspended or adjusted service to destinations in and around Mexico's Jalisco state as violence erupted in the aftermath of a senior cartel leader's killing. The State Department advised American citizens in parts of Jalisco and other states to shelter in place and avoid non-essential travel. Adding to airport strain, the Department of Homeland Security said the suspension of its global entry program that started over the weekend would remain in place until the partial government shutdown ends. Global entry allows pre-approved travelers to use expedited kiosks when entering the United States from abroad. The suspension could mean longer wait times for some returning passengers. In all, more than 5,600 flights into, out of, or within the United States were canceled Monday, according to FlightAware. More than 1,900 U.S. flights already were canceled for Tuesday. The sudden and widespread cancellations left many travelers in a lurch, scrambling to piece together alternative plans. Impromptu hotel bookings, frantic refreshes of airline websites, stress, and even some adventures. Smith, a sales worker at a Somerville chocolate company, said he had some luck. He's now scheduled to return home Thursday afternoon, but can stay with friends until then. In the meantime, he says, his wife must care for herself and tend to the needs of the family dog. "We have to put these little snow boots on the dog," Smith said. "Bending over at this stage in pregnancy is getting a little more difficult." For Somerville resident Alexandra Phillips, the weather seemed a secondary concern. Since her Sunday flight was canceled, Phillips told the Boston Globe, she has been stuck in Mexico, where the U.S. Embassy has urged American citizens residing in certain localities across the country to shelter in place due to cartel violence. Other travelers have been less stranded than spared. "Can't say we are too upset to be missing the blizzard," Westwood resident Ann Nassen told the Globe after her family's flight home from Aruba was canceled. "We are stuck in paradise on a tropical island." Her two young children shed no tears over the delayed return. "They were so excited when they got news of their extended stay," Nassen said. Still, even the most idyllic of prolonged vacations have their costs. Nassen, an occupational therapist at a public school, has had to coordinate with school officials about her possible absence in the days to come. Smith, the chocolate salesman, says he may have to take some unwanted personal time off since he doesn't have his work materials with him. That concludes this Tuesday's reading from the Boston Globe. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.
You were just listening to the Boston Globe for the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
These are the obituaries as published in today's Boston Globe, dated Tuesday, February 24th, 2026. from Boston, Alfred W. Blago, David Ignatius Driscoll of Brighton, David Ignatius Driscoll of Charlestown, Gerald Griffin Sheeran Jr. of Cohasset, Catherine Margaret Bradley of Coleraine, Michael Corrigan of Concord, Gerald Griffin Sheehan Jr. of Dedham, Charles C. DeCrossi.